How about that? Yeah. That worked. Okay, it's that on switch. That's the key to it. Okay, and so we might try to entertain ourselves this morning with trying to answer the question, so what? You know, one way to measure the output of our field is not maybe in a resolution, but which sentences, which paragraphs did we change or add in Bruce Albert's, you know, Molecular Biology of the Cell? We might ask ourselves that question. Where does our work come into a mechanistic understanding of what's actually happening inside of a cell? And so what I'm going to do is give a few vignettes from work that we've been doing about example applications of cryotomography. And I've just picked them to show a variety of examples rather than carry on a specific theme. So let's begin by just thinking, you know, after generation of biochemistry has given us this. This is the blood, sweat, and tears of 100 years of biochemistry. And so people are already building models of cells now where the concentration of each of these species is kept track of as a variable, and all the reactions are maintained, are kept track of with differential equations. And they can even, in E. coli now, predict pretty well the doubling rates in different media. And they can even predict if we knock out a specific enzyme, how will that affect the doubling rate? And they get it right about 70% of the time. This is a recent paper that I was familiar with. And so are we ready to model the cell? Well, this is a movie that I think everyone has seen. But this illustrates the other view of a cell. Now, this is a eukaryotic cell. This comes from the inner life of the cell from ex vivo. And I think you've all seen it. But this represents the other view of the cell. And the funny thing about this...
Does he?
It's beautiful. The funny thing about this is, you know, where is the microtubule in this model? You know, and where is glucose in this model? You know, we really have to bring these models together. And I think that's one of the tasks of our generation, one of the tasks that we'll be able to contribute to enormously through cryo-EM. So as an example, if we were to try to fit those two models, those two views of the cell together, a nice place to start would be a relatively more simple bacterial cell. So here's E. coli. And, you know, after 100 years of microbiology, we understand a lot of the biochemistry, but there's some other aspects of microbiology. We still are, it's kind of sobering how clueless we are about other aspects of microbiology. For instance, why do these bacteria all have different shapes? We don't know that yet. We don't know how bacteria make the shape the way they do. We don't know things like this one maintains polarity. It knows its front end from its back end. How does it do that? When these bacteria segregate their or copy their chromosomes, how do they segregate them? So one's on each side. We don't know that. How do they actually organize themselves and then divide in the middle? You know, there's much left to be learned about all these questions. So we find ourselves in a situation where the physical, mechanical aspects of actually getting through a cell life, there's still much to be learned. So the first vignette is actually about this. It's one more intro slide. Part of the reason that we're still so ignorant of these physical mechanical aspects of even bacterial cell life is because traditional EM hasn't given us the answers. This is one of the best traditional EMs there are of E. coli. By traditional EM, I mean the cell was cross-linked, dehydrated, plastic-embedded, sectioned, and stained. And in one sense, these techniques have been enormously successful. For instance, in these bacteria, you can see that there's two layers to their cell wall. You can see that there's, you know, a speckled pattern in the cytoplasm, and that there's two different phases inside. And of course, this is the nucleoid. But beyond that, it really hasn't shown us much. We don't know how genomes segregate, polarity is established, shape is determined, whatnot. So the first vignette I'm going to tell you about is some recent progress we've made in one of these questions, which is how do cells divide? And a funny thing is the traditional EM went on for decades and decades and decades, and after all that work, people wrote textbooks saying that bacteria don't have a cytoskeleton. That's one of the distinguishing characteristics of bacteria, is they don't have cytoskeletons, because they had never seen one. Now, that needs to be qualified. There were some obscure papers that showed that there were some cytoskeletal elements, but the textbook said they generally don't have them. Then when GFP was discovered, and then people realized that actually you could localize something inside something even as small as a bacterial cell, there was a burst of discovery. And one of the discoveries was that there was a few filamentous, a few proteins that localize in filamentous patterns by light microscopy. And the first one was FDSC. So if you put a fluorescent tag on FDSC, and this is Colobacter crescentis, you see that it often localizes in what looks like a ring right at the midplane of dividing Colobacter cells. And sometimes it looks like it's only on one side, but that was a detail that was pretty much missed. Everybody calls this the Z-ring. But it was hard to make much further progress by light microscopy because that's about as well as you can see things. It was hard to make any progress with traditional EM because the filaments disappear once you cross-link, dehydrate, and plastic embed. They're just gone. And so we were able to make some progress using cryotomography. Now this I just threw in. This is not Colobacter, but how many people have seen a tilt series from cryotomography? I mean, basically almost everybody. I didn't even understand that everybody here, or most people here, had cryo-EM experience. So we'll move right on to a result. So this is a Colobacter cell that's just in the midst of division. Here's one side of the cell. Here's the other side of the cell. And as you can see, it's just beginning to constrict. And so we recorded a tilt series of that region. And when you take the 3D reconstruction and you take a central slice of that reconstruction, here it is. You can see the cell just beginning to constrict here and here. Now, to understand Colobacter, you need to know that there's a surface layer of proteins, and then there's an outer membrane, a layer of peptidoglycan, and then an inner membrane. And just inside the inner membrane, in these tomograms, we resolved a couple dots here on the inside curvature. And they look pretty much like all the other dots in the cytoplasm from this view. But if you're to cut a cross-section this way through the cell, that appears over here. And just to walk you through it again, there's a surface layer, an outer membrane, a peptidoglycan, an inner membrane. And then you see that these dots are actually part of filamentous structures. And that's what's pointed out by that F over there. These are elongated densities right underneath the membrane, actually 16 nanometers below the membrane. If we take a glancing section right through here, then this is the surface layer, the outer membrane, peptidoglycan, inner membrane, and just inside the inner membrane you see filaments here. So there's no way to cut these to really show what they look like in 3D because they're 3D objects. So you segment them. So here's a segmentation, the inner membrane, the outer membrane, and here's a couple of the filaments inside. Now because of their position and knowing this is a dividing cell, we suspected that these were FTSZ. Here's another example of a cell that's more deeply constricting right here. And we'll just cut right to the segmentation. When we segment that, we see three or four filaments on this side, not exactly at the saddle point, and about three filament fragments on the other side. Again, not exactly at the saddle point, but in the vicinity. And the next task was really to show or test whether or not these were really FTSZ or just something else that was at the division plane. And one of the strategies that we took, and this is actually a nice vignette for this audience because it's, in some sense, it was a nice contribution by cryo-EM, but it also exposes some of the greatest challenges right now in cryotomography. The first great challenge was, how do you show that those are really FTSZ and not just some other filament at the midplane? So we've done the best we could. Hopefully it'll be convincing to you. But the first strategy was to take a mutant of FTSZ. FTSZ is a tubulin homolog. It's a GTPase. And so if you make a mutation in the GTPase site, you can form a hyperstable mutant. It does barely hydrolyze, but not quickly. And if you overexpress that in Colobacter, you get this interesting phenotype where the cells try to divide. There's a cell body, and there's a cell body. And they're connected by this really long isthmus between them where it's been trying to divide, but it never actually succeeds. And it's packed with FTSZ, as evidenced by labeling and fluorescent light microscopy. So here's another example. So as a way to learn more about the filaments and also test whether those filaments we saw were really FTSZ, we did tomography of this mutant. So here's a cell body, and here's a cell body. This is a low mag view, of course, because you recognize the quantifoil holes. And then here's one of those elongated connections between cells, and that's a perfect target right over a hole. And Jolie, who was here at the workshop last year, was the one who did this work. Here's a slice through one of his tomograms of that isthmus. And here again, surface layer, outer membrane, peptidoglycan, inner membrane. And then just inside the inner membrane, maybe you'll be convinced that there's a pattern of dots here that's a little different than in the cytoplasm. And we've cut it, we put our yellow line so you can see where I'm going to take the next cross-section. But it becomes quite convincing when you do a cross-section here along the yellow line. You see here again, surface layer, outer membrane, inner membrane. And then just inside the inner membrane, you see that these are really numerous filaments cutting across there. And so we see a vast increase in the number of these filaments when we overexpress FDSZ in the location where we expected to see them. Here's another example of a cell that's trying to divide. And we'll go right into the segmentation of that region. And what we find is literally hundreds of filaments on either side. And so that's an interesting data point about them. Another thing we did is we tried to compare the dynamics of these filaments to what was known from light microscopy. So what this figure is you know we can't do time-lapse EM because the EM destroys the sample. So instead, the best we can do is try to take tomograms of cells that are in the midst of a progressing mechanism and try to compare what's happening. So this is a cell that's long enough to divide, but it hasn't started constricting yet. Here's a cell that's just barely constricting. This is deeper, quite deep, very deep. And this one mimics the cells that Ken Downing previously published a paper about these, where you could see that the inner membranes had already cinched off and become two separate compartments, but the outer membranes were still intact. So that's kind of the last stage of division. This column is the segmented tomograms of these cells. And then what we've done is you have the two sides of the cell, and we just fillet them open like filleting a fish. And this is left column and the right column. So it's as if you were inside the cell looking at the cell wall. So you can compare the kind of filament structure on the left and right sides of each of these cells. And then here is light microscope images of labeled FTSZ, not of the same cells, but of other cells that are at the same stage of constriction, as far as we can tell by light microscopy. And what's seen is that in the long cells, FDSZ has not yet localized to the midplane there. And then it localizes, it's present, it's present, it's present, it's present, and then even at the very end, it's present. So what we see of these filaments in the wild-type cells is that there weren't any filaments until cells began to constrict, and then filaments appeared, and then they remained there until at the end it's difficult to interpret what we've got there. So in addition to being a little bit more evidence that these are FDSZ, namely that their dynamics match the known dynamics of FDSZ, not only are they in the right location, but they appear and they disappear at the same points. But this also started giving us really important clues to dissect the mechanism. Yeah, please.
The polymerization state of FDSZ has been controversial because no one knows in vitro. So do you see like some characteristic multiples? Have you looked at this?
Yeah, we just don't have that resolution yet. We can't see the periodicity along those filaments.
Yeah, or even along the axis, right? Whether a number of protoplasm. I mean, either one. You can't see axial periodicity, but whether lateral, whether the multiples.
That's a great question. So in that overexpression mutant where we had hundreds, they did space very regularly, and it was 9.8 nanometers apart. And bizarrely, that doesn't match any of the crystal structures. There's two or three crystal structures in it. So we didn't really learn much from that. But in the wild type, one of the important take-home messages of this slide is going to be that there doesn't seem to be a specific lateral interaction between the filament fragments. So I think that regular lateral interaction in the mutant is kind of an artifact of being packed with FDSZ. In wild-type cells here, there isn't a specific lateral interaction, at least not in Colobacter. So some of the clues that we gleaned here about mechanism are, first of all, when people saw the light microscope images of FDSZ rings, I imagine that, like me, everybody imagined that FDSE must be a ring, and then maybe we're going to discover some motor protein in there that just cinches them down, and that's how you do constriction. You just cinch down more and more. Well, a prediction of that model would be that you'd have a complete ring, number one. Number two is as the cell constricted, you'd start to get more and more and more rings of FDSE, and you just see like a spiral, a coil, growing. In fact, what we saw is that we saw fragments of filaments here. They're small, they're short filaments, I should say, rather than complete rings. And the other thing is that they didn't seem to increase in number from the beginning of constriction to the end of constriction. It was always roughly about the same number, and they were kind of scattered, and they didn't seem to have a lateral interaction, and they weren't complete rings either. Another bizarre point is that there was a different number of filaments on one side of the cell than the other. In the most extreme case, we had 9 filaments on one side and none on the other. And that just doesn't jive with some kind of mechanism where you have a ring that's being... Light microscopy had also indicated that the FDSE is very dynamic. And so if you track an individual monomer, it comes into the ring and leaves the ring about every 10 seconds. So the ring is constantly being remodeled. And that was always puzzling to people that were advocating this model of a stable ring being cinched down by some motor. And there's also no motor known. And so there were some problems there. So here's another aspect of cryo-EM, a major limitation that this work exposes, which is that we've got this missing wedge. And so one of the reviewers was astute enough to point out, well, how can you tell me that these are fragments, you know, instead of complete rings when you can't see them around the whole entirety because of the missing wedge? It was a very good point. And our response was, well, our inner membranes and our outer membranes serve as internal controls. I'm going to try to illustrate this, and then I'll come back. Now, so try not to read the words, because I'm talking about a different point here. But the point I'm going to make is that in these cross-sections of cells, the inner membrane and the outer membrane serve as almost ubiquitous controls of how far we can see up and down a structure before we lose it because of the missing wedge. And many of the filaments were seen to terminate or end before they reached that angle that they would be blurred out by the missing wedge. So we're very confident that they're just fragments, but this work certainly exposes the point that, for instance, I don't know how far that filament extends because I can see that we're losing resolution because of the missing wedge on our membranes, which I'm sure extend further. And so in many cases, we couldn't say exactly how long the filaments were, but in many cases, we could also say confidently that they were just a fragment. So more to the point of how do you prove a filament is what you think it is with electron cryotomography. Of course, we desperately need a label. And some of you might choose to work on that, developing a label for cryotomography. We did the best we could looking at different expressions and mutants. So first of all, so this is just kind of a summary of all the controls. I don't usually show it, but this group is probably interested. So here's a tomogram from a wild-type cell. And there are 2 cytoskeletal filaments that are thought to localize at the mid-cell during division. One is FDSZ, which I'm talking about, and the other one is MREB, which is an actin homolog. And the light microscopy suggests that it also collapses to the midplane during cell division. And MREB turns out to be sensitive to this small molecule called A22. In fact, E22 will depolymerize MREB. And so one of the controls was to add A22 to these cells and show that the filaments persisted, saying that they're not MREB. Another thing you can do is you can try to deplete the cells of FDSE. You can't knock it out completely, but you can deplete it. And when you deplete the cells of FDSE, they don't constrict anywhere. And cell division fails, and you just get these very elongated, well, filamentous cells. And so we kind of, by obligation, took a bunch of tomograms kind of at random spots in these cells and never saw filaments like the ones we had seen at constrictions. But perhaps a more compelling piece of evidence is that we could overexpress 2 different types of FDSE. This is overexpressing wild-type FDSE. And what happens is that these cells also fail to constrict because constriction depends on just the right ratios of FDSE with all the other proteins that are involved in constriction. Turns out there's about 12, and they're called the divisome. And FTSZ is just the beginning. And so if you overexpress FTSZ, you have division defects because there's not the right ratio of FTSZ to the other stuff. But you get these beginnings of constrictions, and we could show an increase in the number of filaments right at these constrictions, 6 or 7 over here and 6 or 7 over here. And they were also short, like they appeared in the wild-type cells. But if we overexpress this more stable mutant of FTSZ, now we get hundreds of filaments because it doesn't hydrolyze at all, and they're much longer. On average, they're quite a bit longer, as you'd express for something whose stability was increased. One of the reviewers said, well, what if this is a filament that doesn't normally appear in the wild type, but all of a sudden, if you express this mutant FTSZ, all of a sudden this new filament appears in huge numbers at the division plane? And our response was, well, these also manifest the effects of how stable that filament is, and that's the strongest case we could build. You bet. Yeah.
Quite smooth.
Yeah.
Not quite as smooth
as
the other pan would be.
Yeah.
But then in E, it's extremely
striated. Is that, what does that come from? Yeah. Zhou did this one using IMODS segmentation features, and these are in Amira. And that's all it is. It's just, the method of segmenting. When you segment things plane by plane, one slice and you draw where you think the membrane is, you go to the next one and you draw it, and you go to the next one and you draw it. And then you put them all together, you find it's really corrugated and messy. And so different programs have different facilities to smooth that and look at it at different planes and combine the results. IMOD was really designed to do things slice by slice. Amira was designed from the beginning to handle 3D MRI data. That's it. That's all there is. But yeah, so appreciate that you're looking so carefully. So... there's a vignette of identifying a filament, and I've explained to you how strong a case we could make that it was FTSZ. It may not be Loctite like it would be if we had a label, but I find it compelling. So now, what did we learn about the mechanism? Were we able to, contribute in that sense? And one of the things we noticed is that some of the filaments were really quite straight. There were segments of the filaments that looked straight, and then there was other segments that looked very gently curved. So there's a curved one. Here's another straight one, and then there's an abrupt kink. Now, biochemistry had shown that if you purify FTSZ and you put it with GTP, it preferentially polymerizes into straight forms. You can get them to bend, but they predominantly go into straight forms. If instead you incubate them with GDP, then they seem to prefer curved conformations. You can get them to go straight, but they seem to prefer the curved. So the in vitro biochemistry is a little bit messy, but they had these clues. In addition, Ava's group recently produced really strong evidence that FTSZ, the homologue, produces a force by going through a transition between a straight and a curved conformation. Remember her work, she was showing a microtubule, and in a microtubule, all the filaments are loaded with GDP, except at the very top where there's a GTP cap. And there's another protein complex, the DAM1 ring, which is like my watch hanging on it, and when the GTP cap falls off, the protofilaments flay open, and as they flay open, that transition from a straight to a curved conformation drive something down the microtubule. And so this idea that a tubulin homologue would produce force by going from a straight to a curved conformation through the hydrolysis of GTP was a new idea a couple years ago, but we're going to borrow it here to interpret this. The final clue is that in some cases it appeared that the filaments were anchored into the membrane, like here. And some cases, it looked like there was even connections between the filament all the way through the inner membrane up into the peptidoglycan. And in other cases, the filament looked isolated. Now, this is there were many, many examples of this. because any one particular example, one of the dangers of tomography is that people will take a whole tomogram and they'll have even search algorithms that search for something in particular they're looking for. They'll find some noise that looks like what they wanted and then they interpret it. That's very dangerous. So we try to control ourselves by only talking about stuff that we see over and over and over. We can't do a resolution test on one particular thing, although I realize some of you are working on trying to produce resolution tests for tomography, but I think the most robust sanity check here is can you image multiple examples and see some phenomena over and over and over and over when you're not searching for it statistically. So we put these clues together into this working hypothesis, a mechanistic hypothesis of how FTSC does its thing. So we envision that FTSC is monomeric in the cytoplasm and it gets loaded with GTP. When it's loaded with GTP, according to the in vitro biochemistry, it polymerizes into a preferentially straight filament. And we imagine those straight filaments contacting the wall and then being anchored to the inner membrane and perhaps the peptidoglycan as well by the other proteins of the divisome, like FDSA and others. Then, through hydrolysis of GTP, it prefers a curved conformation, which turns out very gently, very subtly, it's not a big pinch, but it very subtly pinches the membrane down just a little bit. And then there's other proteins that build on FDSZ. It's like a scaffold, and it directs the synthesis of peptidoglycan behind the inner membrane. So we imagine that here it would build peptidoglycan behind the advancing membrane, and then it itself depolymerize, exchange the nucleotide, and do a round. So instead of having a stable ring that gets cinched down, we imagine cell division as being a rapid-fire process of hundreds of events, maybe thousands of events, of small fragments hitting the membrane, pinching a little bit, and coming off. And this is a little bit more in harmony with the idea that it could constrict all different diameters. You know, any other mechanism, you would imagine that FTSC would have a favorite curvature, and once you hit that favorite curvature, you're a little bit in trouble, unless you had a motor driving it. And in this case, you can have any size constriction, and this mechanism works because straight filaments hit, pinch a little bit, and then go away and get ready to remodel. So that work exposes, you know, a contribution and also the greatest challenges of tomography. Identifying filaments, making sure things we see are reproducible, and the missing wedge. Please. We saw some really short ones, but I guess we couldn't really because you see these densities, and after they're a lot longer than anything else you see, you start calling them a filament. But, you know, a three monomer FDSZ pattern would look like a somewhat elongated thing, and so I can't really say what the minimum length is. Do you understand? I didn't mean to be facetious, but there are things of all different elongation, ellipses, eccentricities of an ellipse, you know. And when they get really, really long and skinny, we start calling them a filament. But there's everything in between. Let's take a question from Bob.
There's always the possibility that filaments are going out of the plane of the particular slice.
Yeah, good question. So we did look at that, and it's pretty easy to get a measurement of the degree to which they're not exactly perpendicular, because in IMOD you can use that slicer function and just start, you know, rocking exactly how you're cutting it until you see the filament in its greatest length. And so by doing that, we came out with a histogram of the angular deviation from exactly perpendicular to the long axis of the cell, and it's about 5 degrees. And unfortunately, it didn't make any sense. We were kind of hoping. Colobacter is a polar. So you have a stalked pole, and then you have the future swarmer pole. And it would have been cool if they had always been curving right-handed, say, or left-handed, but they weren't. They were more erratic. And, you know, that would be a more robust way for a cell to go about division. Instead of having a very tight, specific division plane in Colobacter, the whole thing just kind of caves gradually. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that's because the positioning mechanisms aren't perfect, and you have these fragments doing their job, and their angular tilt is just a little bit off perpendicular. Gosh, there was something else I wanted to mention about that. It was important. Oh, yeah. But there's other filaments that we won't even be able to do that for because they're not planar. They're actually helical themselves. And so in that case, there's no way to cut this thing and actually see the filament. And so we're working hard to develop algorithms. Back, one of your colleagues, Sonia, here, is from my group, and she's working hard to develop algorithms to computationally find filaments within these low signal to noise ratio reconstructions so we can find stuff that we never saw visually that's actually not planar. David.
Did you ever see a case where you see a filament that's anchored at both ends in the membrane to sort of support the model? The examples you showed had one end stuck in the membrane.
That's right.
If FITC is polar,
that's right.
There'd be two, might be two different attachments at the opposite end. So.
Yeah, and also I'm open to the possibility that some of the attachments are in the middle of a filament. So the first answer to your question is no. I don't recall a single filament that had two attachments, and that's a problem. But now to go on, I could say that there were also some where they seem to have their attachments in the middle of a filament. Here's one that seems to be attached at its end. Here's one that seems to be attached to its end, and here's one. This is probably the weakest part of the evidence here, is these attachments, because you know you can look out here in the middle of the media where we shouldn't have any densities at all, and you know densities arise because of noise. And if one of them happened to appear right there, they would look to us like a connection. So, you know, I tried hard to make the text of the paper say, like, that, you know, we see these connections many times, and they might be thus and such. But it's not like a crystal structure, where you say, this is where the atoms are. Yeah, you know.
But the other question is, I mean, if you, membranes, if you sort of have something that's trying to pull on a membrane, if the membrane is fluid, it would just move through the membrane.
Yeah.
So if it adopted a curved form, it wouldn't necessarily pull the membrane in.
Yeah.
At least so.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, good point. It's really crucial that the idea that it connects not just to the membrane, but actually up into the peptidoglycan. It's funny, but the microbiology field believes that the stress-bearing macromolecule here is that peptidoglycan. It's a globally cross-linked. Okay, and if you treat cells with hot SDS and get rid of all the proteins and the lipids and everything besides that peptidoglycan, you get an object that retains the shape of the cell. Everybody thought that was the load-bearing object. But one of the funny things is that in some places you can resolve the peptidoglycan layer better than others. But here it is, and the inner membrane is not pressed up against it like the microbiologists believe it should because of osmotic pressure. They think that that's holding the pressure of the cell. And it doesn't seem to be right connected. But in order to constrict like this, FDSE has to be manipulating the peptidoglycan layer behind it. So if you link in the peptidoglycan and then you pinch in, and then you also build more peptidoglycan behind yourself, I think it's a plausible model. But certainly those details are wild speculation. We have a lot of work left to do.
It looks like in E you have two connections.
Oh, good. Maybe you're helping me.
Except once in a
Yeah, one is more clear and the other is more hypothetical.
But talking about the membranes, yeah. One of the things that I've seen is that there is this picture of the uniform spacing of the membranes, the peptidoglycan and the outer membrane and everything. And I've seen stuff that I'm looking at where you get a lot of variation, especially a pretty wide separation of the inner and outer membrane, which is not what people would lead you to believe is the case, which I think is what you were talking about.
Yeah. Colobacter's pretty tightly regulated. Colobacter's pretty uniform. But my next vignette, when we're done with questions, I'll show you a cell where the flagella are actually in that periplasm, and they're definitely the whole peptidoglycan, the whole membrane stuff remodels to accommodate it. right where it is. So, yeah, but another question.
Is it possible the force of constriction comes from depolymerization instead of just the strength to the bent? I mean, you probably can't see by electron microscopy, but maybe like speckle fluorescence microscopy or something?
So help me out. So say we have a filament, and then pieces of it start leaving.
Right.
How does that constrict?
Maybe it rejoins.
It leaves at one end.
Okay, you get a hole that then rejoins. Okay, so if you had an attachment, and then that attachment slid down the filament while this was depolymerizing, yep, that could work. Or another model is, people have seen by AFM, FDSC filaments often break and then they rejoin pretty rapidly. And so I guess another thing you're suggesting, if there's a filament and it loses a subunit and then it rejoins, you start shortening. Ken?
I'm just wondering, what do you see as the minimum radius of curvature of the filaments and how that relates to the GDP form in vitro?
I'm not sure I'm going to answer that question right. I was thinking that this model was attractive because it could work even if the minimum diameter were two FDSC monomers. You know, you could have a filament two monomers long, and so what's that, 8 nanometers across as your constriction? And if it went from a straight to bent conformation, you could constrict a little. How the membranes actually fuse, well, that's probably going to be another mechanism. But what about the in vitro stuff? What were you thinking? That part of the question? What's that curvature there? I don't have a number for it. Let's look at this together. This is about our most constricted cell. That's about the most deeply constricted cell. And so you may need to trust me on that, but that's the same size as a ribosome. I don't know if it is a ribosome, but that's the same size as a ribosome. So we're talking about 200, 180 to 200 nanometers across in this constriction. And so I believe that this is a filament, and I believe that's a filament. So we saw shorter filaments than that, but I don't know if we ever saw any more curved than that. Yeah. So it's probably almost for sure that there's two mechanisms that have to hand off eventually. You might have one mechanism for the beginning, and there's got to be another, at least one more mechanism to do the membrane fusion.
Exactly. But this suggests that there's still some force available.
Yeah, but wouldn't you agree, Ken, that even if this were half the diameter and you spanned it with a straight filament and then you went into the curvature of a FDSZ filament, you would still get a constriction. So if, you know, these are like cords hitting a curved surface, and I think that if they were more like diameters, I mean, it could even work, the mechanism could work even if it was only two monomers long. Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's interesting enough that I have a slide about that. I wonder if I can access it quick enough just to make this fun. My resolution's weird, so. But Joe's made a little progress on that now. We've looked at a mutant that... I'm not going to do all these slides, don't worry. I just have a bunch of slides at the end, just in case the right question comes around. Okay, I'm not going to find it quickly, but he's been looking at a mutant now with FDSA overexpressed as well, and it looks like that its role is to link the FDSZ filaments together. And so we think cryo-EM can contribute and make further progress now by trying to dissect the rest of the divisome. Okay, so let's go on to the next vignette and see if it'll elicit some more interesting discussion. Yeah, let's do this one. Okay. The next one is going to be about this cell, Treponema promethea. And this is a long, skinny spirochete. And one of the things that makes it spirochetes unique is that their flagella, whereas you're most everybody's familiar with an E. coli flagella that comes outside the cell, the flagella of spirochetes stay in the periplasm, and they wrap around the cell. So I'm going to show a movie, which is some kind of hybrid between tomography and single particle analysis, where we first reconstructed this cell in 3D, and then we were able to extract out the flagellar motors and produce a 3D reconstruction of the motor. Okay, so I'll try to help you navigate here. So in the cell, there's a flagellum at each tip. So there's going to be one from here, we're coloring it red, and there's one from here that we're coloring blue. First of all, we'll strip off the outer membranes, and then you'll see the blue one starts here, and it wraps around the cell in the periplasm. Here, there's one that we color red that starts here and wraps around, and it joins the blue one. But the point of this movie is that we were able to then take an object that we resolved in a tomogram of a cell, and we computationally extract it and the other one and 10 more from other cells, actually about 20 more. And then, like with 3D single particle analysis, we aligned them, determined the symmetry, and produced a somewhat higher signal-to-noise ratio image of the complete flagellar motor. And that's what this is. Now I'm going to see if I can control this and pause it right here. Let me tell you something about motors. I know a lot of you know a lot about motors. But here's the outer membrane, and here's the inner membrane, and here's the peptidoglycan layer. And this is what some would call the quintessential molecular machine. It's just this fantastic rotary motor. And there is a component called the stator. And the stator, there's a proton gradient that flows through the inner membrane from the periplasm to the cytoplasm. And as the protons flow through, the stator imparts a torque to the rotor, causing the rotor to spin. And when the rotor spins, so does the rod, and so does the flagellum. And this motor also has a transmission, the C-ring, which tells the motor whether to spin clockwise or counterclockwise based on signals from the chemoreceptors. It has bearings. Here's what we call the P collar that grease the peptidoglycan to let things slip more. And David Rozier has played a leading role in this field trying to understand the structure and function of these motors. And one of the things that have been challenging is that when people have tried to approach it by structural biology, the standard thing to do would be to rupture the cells, purify them, and then see if we could do single particle analysis or something helical or something. And that worked great for a lot of pieces of the motor. But it didn't work for the stators. And the reason is because the stator's job is to lock up into the peptidoglycan, which is this globally cross-linked object, and hold on and never let go. Because they have to hold on to the peptidoglycan so that they can push against something to give the torque on the rotor. So when you start to take these apart and purify them, people were able to purify the rotor and the rod, and kind of surprisingly enough, the C-ring came with it in many cases. But the stators were left in the membrane fraction that gets pelleted at the bottom of your cell rupture centrifuge tube. And so it was kind of a mystery how many stators there were, what was their configuration, what do they look like. And so this is just kind of an example of the way tomography allows you to get a low-resolution structure of a complete macromolecular complex that probably will only exist inside an intact cell. So how are we going to go further? Well, we need crystal structures, we need NMR structures, and we need single particle structures and helical analysis. Everybody knows Keiichi Namba has been doing terrific work on many pieces of this. And we'll probably add some information from tomography about the shape of it, especially those components that are embedded in the cell to allow us to put it all together. And this is David and his colleagues' single particle reconstruction of the Salmonella motor. And here is the motor that I just showed you from Treponema promethea. We've gone on to do this out of a number of bacteria, the Colobacter motor and a Vibrio motor and a motor from Hylomonella gracilis. And one of the interesting things that comes out of this is, it's a little bit philosophical, but these motors have become adapted to the specific needs of each motor. For instance, this one probably has to have a lot more torque because it causes the whole end of the cell to gyrate. It's bending the entire end of the cell to gyrate as it swims, whereas the other motors just have to spin their flagellum. And one of the things we notice about it is that its stators are just spread way out. And that's a possible gearing mechanism. It's like it's geared down by increasing the lever arm so that with the same force from a proton flowing through can generate more force to rotate something. So there's there's interesting stuff to learn even at the level of, 5-6 nanometer resolution where you just see the shape of things inside of a cell.
And how many tonographs do you average to get this?
You know, that motor that I showed was 10 tomograms. Each had two motors, so that's 20. And it's just like the first pass. And we didn't do any CTF correction, so let me just highlight that on the board. Something we'd like to see done is CTF correction across tilt series so we can do CTF-corrected tomograms. It may not allow us to see anything new in an individual tomogram, but when you average pieces of tomograms, if you can do the CTF correction, then you have the possibility of getting to higher resolution. It was about 20. I also want to mention that, I think everybody has heard Wolfgang Baumeister make the important point that a lot of complexes may only exist inside the cell. And so that's going to be a contribution of cryotomography, to visualize these things inside the cell, figure out which pieces are really attached into factories of machines inside the cell that we may never be able to isolate by purify them. Okay, the next vignette is about a virus, and it's HIV. And so for those of you who want to make a contribution in virology, here's an example. The introduction to HIV that you need to understand how cryotomography has contributed is that when HIV builds itself, first the infected cell produces what's called a polyprotein named GAG and has pieces, the matrix piece, a capsid piece, a nucleocapsid piece, domains in it. And these all just line up vertically along the membrane. And because they're shaped something like a piece of pizza, skinnier at the bottom than they are at the top, this naturally induces membrane curvature. And after you have a whole assembly of them, then you have a spherical particle that can bud off out of the cell. And then an enzyme called protease is released, and protease cleaves between nucleocapsid and capsid, and it cleaves between capsid and matrix. And so these domains become independent, and they restructure. The matrix stays in a spherical shape on the edge of the cell. The capsid proteins rearrange to form this cone-shaped core, and nucleocapsid probably changes also inside, and it's coding the genome. And that's the process called maturation. Most everybody has heard of protease inhibitors. They inhibit that enzyme, so it can't mature, and that's why HIV infection no longer people can live for a long time with HIV infections. So here's a tomogram of the mature form of HIV. And I keep telling this story because HIV is the most studied object by structural biology, period. There are hundreds and hundreds of structures in the PDB of HIV proteins. And HIV only has 14 proteins. And there's hundreds and hundreds of structures. So the other thing it illustrates is that getting a crystal structure of something is not the end of the story. There are hundreds of crystal structures of protease and other enzymes of HIV. And there's thousands in existence, but about 90% of them are confidential in databases of pharmaceutical companies. But even the PDB has thousands. And so it's kind of interesting that even with all these structural information, people don't know how the structure of HIV, because they don't know how to fit the pieces together into the whole. And the reason is because HIV is heterogeneous. So when you look at a prep of HIV of virions, here's one, and there's a virion, and there's a virion, and this is a mess. And your eyes can do the 3D reconstruction well. You see there's a cone-shaped core in that one. There's a cone-shaped core in that one. But this one has some kind of rod-shaped core, and it looks like it's even more complicated. And so crystallography is never going to work on this. NMR is never going to work because they're heterogeneous. And so this is the realm of cryotomography. From a tilt series like that, we were able to produce a reconstruction like this. And you can see that there really is quite a variety. Some of the viruses have cone-shaped cores. Others have kind of what we would call pleomorphic cores. And some had rod-shaped cores and even multiple cores. And this big one actually has a core inside of it, a nested core. And the leading idea for how these form is it's called the fullerene cone model. And it was proposed by Wes Sundquist. And the idea is that you can have a hexagonal lattice. And you have a hexagonal lattice. And you can roll that up into a sheet. So you now you have a hexagonal tube. That's a hexagonal, a helical tube. If you want to close that tube, you have to introduce 12 and exactly 12 pentagons in the places of hexagons. And that each one introduces kind of a pucker. The geometry word for it is a disclination. And if you have 12, it can close off the object. And so in an icosahedron, you have six of these disclinations, pentagons, and six on the bottom, and they're staggered and equally spaced. And that's an icosahedron. But you could just pull these six up and the bottom six down, and you could put any length of helical tube in between, and that would give you a rod. The other thing you can do is you can take one of the pentagons and move it down to the bottom, and so you have different curvature, and that gives you a cone. You might have five up here and seven down here, and then you get a cone, or four and eight, or nine and three. And these are fullerene cones, and there's a very predicted cone angle for each of these distributions of pentagons. And by reconstructing the viruses in 3D, we could measure those cone angles. And it turns out they matched just beautifully with the prediction for a 5-7 fullerene cone to substantiate Wes's model. The next example is application of cryotomography to the immature virus. So same virus, HIV, and remember I said in the immature form, the GAG polyproteins, they stick into the membrane, normal to the membrane, and form a spherical shell. So here's the tilt series, and there's an immature virus. Here's the 3D reconstruction of an immature virion, and then the next pass we'll have it at a higher scale. And you can see that layer there of the GAG polyprotein. And one of the things to notice is that when we just cut the top of it, you'll see a hexagonal pattern appear right there. Right there. And we'll go back through right there, hexagonal pattern, as we cut through the right layer. And so we were able to show, and this actually follows some really beautiful work from Mark Yeager and colleagues in a related virus that the GAG, and Steve Fuller as well, that the GAG polyprotein was hexagonally packed. But one thing we discovered by getting an intact virus in 3D is that the GAG had patches. And we'll get into that more, but it wasn't a complete shell. It was just patches on the surface. And that helps to explain the budding process. But the next thing we could do with tomograms is we could dissect them. We take this layer, which is the nucleocapsid, and we could project all the density of the nucleocapsid layer onto a surface. And then the C-terminus of capsid and the N-terminus of capsid onto its surface, and then the matrix. And we could ask, at what level does the hexagonal order exist? Where is the hexagonal order? And so now we can pull it apart and computationally dissect this particle. And you see that the matrix layer really doesn't have any periodicity. But the N-terminus and C-terminus of capsid, these are hexagonally packed. Nucleocapsid, there's no periodicity there. So we could also resolve which domains were critical for this hexagonal packing of GAG. Now, in addition, now we're in a position to actually pick out key unit cells here. So the first thing we do is we notice that if we try to identify the unit cells, as it were, in this structure, sometimes the packing is horrible, and sometimes you have nice hexagonal packing, and then you have these patches where it's just not even symmetric at all. And so, this won't give you any good diffraction, but we can computationally, like a single particle project, pick out a couple unit cells that are really nicely ordered. So they're colored in red. We'll take that one and that one, but in fact we took hundreds. We can now extract that, and for the non-structural biologists, we made this movie to show that you could then align them in 3D, and then we average them, and what we get is a higher signal-to-noise ratio reconstruction of a particular unit cell of the GAG lattice. And it turns out that this was sufficient to make some important predictions about how the atomic structures fit in. So I'll let it go at least till we get to the atomic structures. Now, the resolution you wouldn't expect you could fit in an atomic model, but so much is known about these proteins that we could at least propose a way that they would fit. And so I put fits not exact, you know, because they're not. But the architecture is quite interesting. The key point to it is that this is a spacer peptide, and nobody really knew what it would do. And the structure suggests that this spacer peptide forms a bundle, a helical bundle in there, and that actually there's a new type of drug candidate that stabilizes this. And this, like a bouquet of flowers, holds together a hexagonal lattice in the immature form, and it has to be cleaved before you can mature. So here's our... This is a... Oh, hold on. Let me pause this because we've got a question coming. You want to ask a question first?
Excuse me. There is a crystal structure for the N-terminal domain for a retrovirus, which forms a nice hexamer from the N-terminal domains. And to my recollection, it doesn't look like what you have there is fit.
Yeah. So there's the immature form and there's the mature form. And the structure I'm aware of... Yeah, this is immature. Okay, good. All right, so you're going to enjoy this movie. Now, this movie, there's a lot of stuff that's just crazy, and we're not done, and we haven't made it available, but some of it is actually useful. So I'll try to tell you which parts those are. So this is a model of the immature lattice, and here's one of the GAG polyproteins, matrix, capsid, the spacer, and the nucleocapsid. And so they're arranged, you know, normal to the surface. And these are proteases. Protease come in and clip. And as soon as they clip this off, and then they clip the spacer protein off, now the thing is allowed to flex. It's like a bouquet of flowers held together. Once you remove that, now it can flex. Now the next step is that protease then clips between capsid and matrix, and freeing capsid to completely adopt a different structure. And here's what you were talking about. Once that clips, the N-terminus refolds to form this hairpin, and this is known from crystallography. Then the hairpin can then mediate a new set of contacts to form a different lattice in the mature form. And so there's two molecular triggers, as it were. That's the part that is not right. So I stopped that. So there's two molecular triggers. It has to cut below it. It has to cut above it. There's a refolding. And then the thing can adopt a completely different packing arrangement. So there were some things that we were able to see from getting tomograms of complete cells, I mean complete viruses, that had not been understood before just from the projection images. And this was a well-studied object and continues to be so. It wasn't for lack of effort. You know, in aggregate it is, because you can, you know, trigger something and then sometime later purify it all and ask how many cleavages have happened and where in the GAG. But that would be a statistical population study.
The reason I ask is because in another virus, MULB, it's actually the matrix that's cleaved first, which, again, topologically doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I don't put a lot of weight in those because it could be different for the different GAG monomers. There might be one that's predominantly seen, but there's also the possibility that protease is acting in a particular spot. It could act almost anywhere. Now, this idea though that the GAG is only packing in patches and it's not continuous allows that a protease could get up and get access to the matrix capsid. Okay, David.
So these patches, this patches,
Yeah, good question. Oh, you know what? I'll run this movie to that point. I think this is going to be a good answer. Okay, here. So I'm going to roll this. And certainly the missing wedge is affecting how well each face is resolved. But because viruses are so small, you know, the missing wedge isn't... it's diminished in impact. And the other thing is that the patch effect wasn't... It's not like we saw disorder at the top and the bottom of the viruses. It was spread out. And it was different on different viruses. So it wasn't an artifact of the missing wedge. But the missing wedge did make everything more difficult to see on every virus at the top and the bottom.
But I think that's certainly an interesting way that the viruses are getting around having to form the pentamers. They would have to form pentamers here to get over the sphere.
Yeah, it just, you know, removed that issue entirely. There's no more issue about closed, well, from my point of view, about the closed connection in the immature particle. Still an issue for the mature particle, but not the immature. The other thing, it might account for the fact that when you have a neck region of membrane and then you cinch it off, you could have a bunch of extra membrane associated with a virus that never was really coated with GAG lattice beforehand. So it accommodates, you know, a real variety of how much membrane you have associated with it. Okay, Bridget Gimtel, just a couple more minutes and I'll... So I'm going to go to our last vignette, which I think will be the most fun to get feedback on. Lou, this is the stuff Lou gave me last week. He's here with you, and it was his poster. So finally, the very smallest thing we've ever tried is the peptidoglycan. Now, in order to really understand bacterial shape, we need to know not just where the filaments are, but what they do. And their key... The key thing that they do is they govern how the peptidoglycan is built. So, intro to the peptidoglycan. In bacteria, gram-negative bacteria, you have an outer membrane, a lipid bilayer. You have an inner membrane, another lipid bilayer. And then there's this layer in between called the peptidoglycan. And it's another one of these cases where we've known a lot about the chemistry for decades. In fact, we know the peptidoglycan is built from these disaccharides, and they are linked together to form these glycan strands. And then the glycan strands are linked by peptide cross-links. They're usually 5 amino acids across. And so we've known this for forever. People have taken these cell walls that you can purify just this peptidoglycan layer. When you purify it, but it still has the shape of the cell, you call it a sacculus. And they can take sacculi and do small-angle X-ray scattering to try to look for the periodicities, and there aren't any, except for the fact that there seem to be a disaccharide spacing. And so we still don't know the architecture of the peptidoglycan. One model is what Lou called the layered model, where the glycan strands lie on the surface of the cell, and then we don't know whether it would be parallel to the long axis of the cell or perpendicular or something in between, but they would lie on the surface of the cell and be connected by the peptide crosslinks. But more recently, this was the favored model for a decade or two, but more recently this model was proposed by a group that did some NMR of glycan strands, and they proposed that the glycan strands were actually normal to the surface of the cell, linked by the peptides like ladders, rungs of a ladder. And of course, but you know, nobody has any data to really resolve these. So what Lou did is he purified these sacculi. So here is the edge of one. This is from Colobacter. And in Colobacter, they have these stalks, and they're otherwise banana-shaped, but we only see half of it here. And so he treats it with hot SDS, you know, detergent. Everything that's not covalently linked to the sacculus is gone, except for these storage granules in here. They're interesting. They remain. But so here it's shape, and it's like a balloon that's all the air is deflated, the two layers. It used to be cylindrical. It just fell down, it collapsed on itself. And so now it's two layers thick. And the ice was extremely thin, about 50 nanometers thick. And so we could hope for the best resolution that you can obtain, at least with our instruments. And here's a image of that sacculus, and here's a slice through the tomogram where individual fibers can be seen. So here's a movie to give you a better view of these fibers in 3D. Here's a hole, and this is a sacculus. Okay, it's hard to see. But here's the edge of the sacculus, and here we're going to do volume rendering on the fibers, so it's not a segmentation, it's a volume rendering to try to make it more honest. Here we'll go through slices through it, and you see individual fibers. And I believe that these fibers are the remnants of glycan strands. And the interpretation then would be that the glycan strands are in fact laying on the surface of the cell. They're predominantly perpendicular to the long axis of the cell, but they're not in a regular pattern. They're going to be more like this. And that would explain why nobody ever saw any characteristic spacings by small angle X-ray scattering, is because the glycan strands themselves are kind of random. I mean, kind of like this pattern in that carpet. They're just laying around, but on the surface, linked by the peptides. And so I think this is a vignette that illustrates how cryotomography may give us structures of objects that don't have a periodic structure. And we might know an enormous amount about the pieces that go into them, but what's missing is just how do they go together to form the full structure. And it looks like this is how the peptidoglycan is formed. And so hopefully in the future we'll be able to relate how the cytoskeletal structure of bacteria govern the construction of a peptidoglycan layer like this, and divide and establish polarity and all those other questions that I raised at the beginning. And let's close there. Let me go to add some slides about, you know, what our technology lacks, what we think are the things to be working on. If you want to talk about that, maybe we can, but let's go to this one first, which is some of the folks that have been working with me and now work with some other people. Joe is a postdoc. He was responsible for the FTSZ work that I showed. And Lou is here with you. He did the peptidoglycan layer. Sonia, I don't see you in the picture, but she's right there. She's trying to write software to find filaments. This is Gavin Murphy. You'll see Gavin around because he's now doing a postdoc with Sriram, and his work was on the flagellar motor that I showed. A lot of you know Christian Soloway, who was implementing an automatic tilt series acquisition in Legionon. And a lot of you know Prabha, who used to be here at Scripps. She's been an EM scientist with me. A lot of you will know Ariana Brigel. And that doesn't mean you don't know the others, but let's stop there. Thanks.
Yeah,
that would be good. So the challenge is to get an antibody into an intact cell. No, but you said thin sections. The curious thing is that when people have fixed the cells and then at least dehydrated and plastic embedded them, you don't see filaments anymore. There's something about that process that makes all the filaments go away. Because after 40 years of traditional EM, nobody had ever seen these filaments. Ever. There was no FTSZ, and people were writing textbooks saying there was no cytoskeletal filaments in bacteria. So what if we do the Tokuyasu method where we don't actually plastic embed it? Would the filaments remain as we cross-linked it and then cooled it, sectioned it, then thawed it out enough for antibodies to move? Could we label it then? Maybe, but then what would we do? If we then went on like normal and fixed it and plastic embedded it, then I would expect them to be disappeared again. Can you look at something? Could you just dehydrate it at that point? So that's the fuzziness where I get into it. I just don't know. I'm skeptical that we could get the antibody on it in a way that preserved the filament, because they seemed to disappear. And that's so bizarre. Why did they do that? Eukaryotic cytoskeleton structure has been laid out for the world to see for a long time, because you could fix cells, plastic embed, section, stain them, and there all was. But in bacteria, something about that makes them disappear.
But could they not see them because they're so small? I mean, they're pretty small. You didn't have the resolution in some of these sections.
No, because you know, they're actin homologs, tubulin homologs, and so they certainly resolved actin filaments and microtubules, even protofilaments flaying apart by traditional EM methods in eukaryotes. So it wasn't a resolution problem, you know, and that's kind of fun to look at. Let's look at that again. You know, the resolution of traditional EM is a lot higher than we can achieve by cryo-EM, because you can use more dose. You know, we could resolve this particular hunk of stain, you know, a lot better than we can resolve a protein by cryo-EM, but it's not useful because it's just a hunk of stain. You know what I mean? So it really wasn't a resolution problem. It was a preserving the filament problem.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, but it seems like still, though, I don't know, maybe, I wonder if it'd be worth trying.
We should try, I think, what Nico was leading to, that, you know, where you try to immuno-EM the Tokuyasu sections, but okay.
So since you know that you can attach YFB and get fluorescence and observe the different phases, can you just use that construct to maybe add 28 or 30 kilodaltons of mass to every subunit?
That's a great idea. Yeah, we did that. We took these filaments in wild-type cells and then the cells where the GFP had been tagged to the monomer, and we computationally drew a line down the middle of the filament. And then what we did is an average radial density distribution. You know, we averaged all along that and graphed, you know, how the density fell off as a function of radius. And what we were hoping is that in the GFP-tagged one, we would see a little shoulder. And in fact, we saw nothing. And what I think happened, I mean, it looked identical. What I think is going on is that the GFP, first of all, is a little flexible. So you have an FDSE monomer, a tag, and then the GFP. So the GFP is a little floppy. And in the wild-type cell, it's not like that space is absent. Some other protein bounces into it. So the protein density around the filament is just as high in either case. It would only work if you could have something that was rigidly attached to the filament and you would see, you know, in a particular spot on the filament, a bump all the way down.
Maybe in your mutant where you do have that regular spacing of filaments, 9.8 nanometers.
Yeah.
One last question.
Yeah, it's a good idea. So, would you know, are you thinking of an antibody that would have a heavy metal tag on it?
Well, that would be harder.
Because that's our problem. We can't think of a way to build a heavy atom cluster, although, you know, David's been publishing about metallothionine, and maybe that would
work.
But it's, yeah, it's in, yeah, we haven't immediately tried that, and it may not be enough heavy atoms, but that's the problem. But you're definitely right. We can fuse anything we want right to FDSZ genetically. So the problem is fusing something that's electron dense to it.
Thanks very much,
Ron.